So I'm here today with Professor Gregory Goss, who teaches at the University of Vermont and is a senior fellow at the Brookings Doha Institute. So today our conversation will be about golf security in the golf, starting with a basic history and then moving on to, you know, how is security conceptualized in the golf, and then the show will look at, you know, how has the Gulf reacted to events in Egypt, events in Syria, and then Iran. So let me start off with, you know, give us a contemporary history of the Gulf's security situation. You know, starting in 2003, you know, we do see a lot of like tumult and a lot of change come to the Gulf. So, you know, give us a contemporary history.
Sure. I think that we actually have to go back a little further, but I'll do it I won't take years to describe those years. I think that when we look at the Gulf security structure, it's really a trilateral structure in terms of local power, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. And then you get the smaller Gulf states kind of maneuvering among them. And you had outside powers during the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were allied with local powers, but weren't all that present. Now, I'm talking about pre-1990. After the Iraqi, and then you had the Iran-Iraq War, which was a hugely destructive war, 1980 to 1988. But interestingly enough, hardly changed anything within the region. The much more important strategic change was what preceded the Iran-Iraq War, the Iranian Revolution, and the establishment of the Islamic Republic, which ended the Iranian-American alliance and introduced, a non-status quo player into both the Gulf and to general Middle East international relations. So you had the Iran-Iraq War, incredibly destructive, but doesn't change anything. Then Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, and that really does change things because it brings the Americans in as a direct player into the Gulf. And the United States leads this international coalition, defeats Saddam Hussein, and then sticks around, gets basing privileges in the smaller Gulf states, which had previously kind of kept the Americans more at arm's length. The U.S. builds up its forces in the Gulf. And Iraq, which had been one of those three local poles within the region, begins to weaken. The Kurdish area of Iraq becomes de facto independent. The heaviest, most severe regime of economic sanctions in modern history is laid on Saddam Hussein's regime. And in essence, the Iraqi state starts to kind of rot from within. Right. Finally, you get to 2003, and the United States in the post 9/11 environment, the George W. Bush administration pushes over what's left of the Iraqi state. And then Iraq really becomes not a pole of power in regional politics, but a playing field in which the U.S. tries to construct a pro-American government. The Iranians work against that and basically become the dominant regional influence in Iraqi politics. The Saudis get beaten out of influence in Iraq. The Turks begin to look for influence in the Kurdish areas in Iraq in ways that previously they saw the Kurdish regional government in Iraq as a potential threat. Then they started to see it as a potential ally in regional politics. So what you get up to 2003 is kind of a weakened Iraq, Iran, and Saudi Arabia in a regional balance, with the United States an increasingly important military presence in the region. And after 2003, what you get is a Iraq removed from the regional power balance and becoming a playing field in which, you know, local powers and the United States try to gain influence. And America, you know, more and more sucked into trying to police the domestic politics and restructure the domestic politics of Iraq, in essence, in the end, in a failed effort to do that.
So then, you know...
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Gregory Goss.
We're back. Walk us through the history then, you know, from, you know, 2010 on. So this is, you know, the United States is reducing its responsibilities to Iraq, you know, sort of withdrawing from the region. And then we have the Arab Spring. So Mubarak is, you know, thrown out in Egypt. Tunisia is, you know, in the middle of change. And then 2011, we have the Syrian war. So walk us through, you know, what has been the Gulf's reaction to this, to these changes?
Right. I think that what we have to do is distinguish between the American withdrawal from Iraq and an American withdrawal from the region as a whole. Because, the Obama administration campaigned on getting out of Iraq and did get out of Iraq. And I think that was a major shift in American policy. But it didn't leave the Gulf, right? We still have enormous numbers of troops and naval forces and air forces in the Gulf region. And we still have this kind of strategic standoff with Iran over the nuclear issue, over Iranian influence in the region. So while the United States certainly left Iraq, and I think basically conceded that the Iranians had won the political game in Iraq, at least in the short term, I don't want to say that the United States left the Gulf. We're still there in a big way. So then, right, the Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings begin in December 2010 in Tunisia. And really the only area of the Gulf itself that's directly affected is Bahrain. And the United States is kind of caught on the Bahrain issue. We have a major naval base in Bahrain, major interests there. And the American rhetoric of democracy promotion would call for us to be supportive of what was a massive popular mobilization for political change in Bahrain. On the other hand, given the fact that the regime in Bahrain is a Sunni ruling family, closely allied with the Saudis and the other Gulf states through the GCC, and the majority of the population of Bahrain is Shia, in the region, this was viewed not simply as a democratic political uprising, but it was also viewed as part of this Iranian-Saudi contest for influence. And the United States was trying to get some kind of compromise between the mainstream Shia opposition group in Bahrain, al-Wefaq, and some of the reformist elements of the ruling family. And at that point, the more hardline elements of the ruling family ask the Saudis for help. Saudi troops come in, the Bahraini forces suppress the popular mobilization. And the U.S. accepts that. It stands back and says, well, there's nothing we can do. And every once in a while, Washington will talk about how there's a need for political reform in Bahrain and a need for dialogue. But in effect, the Americans have accepted that the Bahraini government is not going to follow a reforming course. And the American military installation, the naval installation in Bahrain, kind of trumps any kind of democratic discourse. So that's within the Gulf itself. But of course, this kind of strategic struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran is enormously affected by the Arab Spring, because this kind of cold war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which has really developed from the kind of the mid 2000s in the wake of the Iraqi invasion, you know, that contest is fought out in the domestic politics of weak Arab states, Iraq, Lebanon, the Palestinians, and what the Arab Spring has done is add other potential battlegrounds to that struggle, and the most important of which is Syria. Right? The Saudis see Syria as an effort to roll back, or an opportunity to roll back Iranian influence in the Arab world. And of course, the Iranians have gone all in to support Bashar al-Assad. So from the perspective of kind of sitting in the Gulf and Gulf security, there are really interesting domestic implications to the Arab Spring in Bahrain, to some extent in Kuwait. But more often than not, folks in that region are looking at regional politics through this Saudi, Iranian strategic competition, which has become in many cases kind of a Sunni-Shia sectarian fight. That's the way politics in a lot of these places, Lebanon, Iraq, and to some extent in Syria, have kind of shaken out. And that's the prism through which folks in the Gulf are looking at events of the Arab Spring.
So I'm curious then, I mean, what is the key driver then? I mean, if sort of the lens is sectarianism, then, you know, is the key driver of security in the Gulf domestic? Because it seems like, you know, the reaction, what prompted the Saudi intervention in Bahrain was, you know, was a Shiite, not uprising, but protests, that the narrative was sort of, oh, they're being supported by Iran. I mean, is the key driver here domestic, which then is elevated to the level of foreign policy? Or is it really foreign policy that's sort of, you know, intertwined with a domestic, with the domestic scene?
Well, I think both, let's look at it from the Saudi perspective for a second. I think for the Saudis, the Saudi regime, those two elements of domestic regime security and kind of a balance of power game with Iran push in the same direction, right? On the one hand, they don't want to see any monarchical regimes fall, right? That was the one thing where they really were counter-revolutionary during the Arab Spring. And thus, they were going to preserve a monarchy in Bahrain. At the same time, their balance of power game with Iran said we're not going to let, we, the Saudis, are not going to let a Shia-dominated government come to power in Bahrain for our own domestic reasons, but also because that would be a gain for Iran in our balance of power struggle. And thus, both the kind of regional balance of power game and domestic regime security push in the same direction on the Saudis on the Bahrain issue. They're less phobic about the domestic implications when we go out to Egypt or Libya or Syria or even into Yemen. But when it comes to monarchies, the Saudis are going to support fellow monarchs. And that's part of domestic regime security. I think that the starting place for understanding the security decisions in the Gulf context is domestic regime security. But that's not the only factor. I think for the Saudis, on the Bahrain question, both, you know, regional balance of power and domestic regime security pushed in the same direction.
So let me sort of switch gears and sort of you know, sort of develop this point a bit. You know, how do we look at collective security in the Gulf? I mean, up to now our conversation has been, you know, about the Saudis, and it almost seems like the Saudis really define, you know, collective security, not just in terms of the narrative, but also in terms of the GCC. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, how do we think about collective security in the Gulf? I mean, is this really a matter of, you know, Saudi Arabia is sort of ordering everything around its preferences? Or, you know, do states like Kuwait and the UAE and Qatar sort of have a voice in this, you know, construction?
I think we shouldn't use the term collective security in the Gulf. I don't think that it fits. I think what the GCC is an alliance based on regime type and a common orientation toward the United States, you know, vis-a-vis other big powers in the Gulf, Iraq and Iran. Now, within that alliance, the GCC, there's ups and downs in terms of the cohesiveness of that alliance. At times of really serious threat, they work together. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait at the outset of the Arab Spring, in the wake of the Iranian Revolution and the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War, going back to the founding of it. At times of real crisis, these six states do come together. But when crisis dissipates and you're in a period of more kind of normal politics, some of the smaller states will assert some amount of independent action from Saudi Arabia. These days, of course, it's Qatar that's the most significant player. At the outset of the Arab Spring, the Qataris and the Saudis were very much on the same page. The Qataris supported the Saudi move into Bahrain. You got no coverage on Al Jazeera of things going on in Bahrain. The Saudis and the Qataris were basically on the same page in Libya, in Syria, and in Yemen. As the Arab Spring settled down and it was clear that you weren't going to get kind of domino effects and domestic political crises in the Gulf states, you know, the Qataris and the Saudis started engaging in their more in a more kind of a rivalry for influence in Syria, for example. So I think that collective security is the wrong way to think about the Gulf. I still think of it as balance of power politics in a context where you get quite a bit of transnational connections, and thus foreign policy and domestic policy really do get mixed up. Not just Sunni-Shia stuff across borders, but tribal links across borders, both Sunni and Shia religious links across borders. And thus, it's not a pure kind of billiard ball balance of power situation, but it's certainly not collective security. I mean, to get real collective security in the Gulf, you would have to get the six GCC members plus Iraq, plus Iran, plus international actors, right? It would have to look more like an ASEAN. And, you know, we're nowhere near that in the Gulf.
So, you know, how do we understand GCC sort of security coordination? I mean, you know, where would it be, you know, sort of, can you have security coordination among the GCC states without the United States?
You can have security coordination on domestic issues, and there's quite a bit of that. Quite a bit of information sharing among the interior ministries, that kind of thing. You can have diplomatic coordination, but you can't really have military coordination. I think each of these countries prefers a bilateral military relationship with the United States because the smaller states have long memories. And they can remember back to a time when Saudi Arabia was perhaps the biggest threat to them, you know, say at the beginning of the 20th century. And so I think that for a state like Bahrain or a state like Qatar, a state like the Emirates, they see their bilateral security arrangement with the United States as a guarantee of local independence because they could get swallowed up by the local powers. And thus, it seems to me that military cooperation within the GCC is always going to be pretty limited. And every one of these states very much values its bilateral relationship with the United States.
So, I mean, if you're Kuwait and you have a good relationship with the United States, I mean, to sort of expand on your point, does Kuwait fear Saudi Arabia more or Iran? I mean, Kuwait is sort of, you know, thinking about the United States as sort of a security guarantor against local powers. So, I mean, you know, for Kuwait, is it a fear of Saudi Arabia or is it more of a fear of Iran then? Or is it both?
It's a fear of Iraq, first and foremost. For all the obvious reasons, the Kuwaitis are obsessed with Iraq, and they don't really think that the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime has really changed the historical Iraqi desire to absorb Kuwait. So first and foremost, it's Iraq. But I think that in general, all of the smaller Gulf states, even if they don't see an immediate military threat on the horizon, kind of are more comfortable and have historically been more comfortable given their relationship with Britain that goes back, you know, into the mid-19th century in some cases. They're more comfortable being in a relationship with a great power at some far geographic remove than tying themselves too closely to a local power which can, in essence, absorb them. And thus, I don't see any great difference kind of in historical terms between the role the United States is playing with those smaller Gulf states than the role that Britain played. And thus, in many ways, this is a historical continuity for these states.
So before moving on to policy, one more sort of theory question. And, you know, I'm curious, what has made the Gulf monarchy so resilient in terms of the Arab Spring? I mean, is it really just a matter of, you know, being an oil state and having a lot of cash on hand and being able to sort of buy off domestic constituencies and sort of push money out, so to speak? You know, I mean, what has made the Gulf monarchies so resilient, you know, when we've seen sort of more secular regimes collapse in the matter of, you know, 2-3 years?
I think oil plays an enormous part in this. It's not just the monarchies in the Gulf. If you look at other major oil exporters in the Arab world, or energy exporters, I should say, Algeria, Iraq, they didn't have major upheavals during the Arab Spring. Only Libya and Bahrain had major upheavals. And the only regime change we saw was in Libya, and that's because of foreign intervention. I think that when oil is $100 a barrel, regimes can use that excess cash to maintain the stability of their own rule. I think if Gaddafi were, you know, a better ruler, he could have used the enormous amounts of surplus cash in Libya to head off those uprisings. So I think oil is really enormously important. It's not the only thing, but to me, it's the most important factor that explains the resilience of these monarchies.
I mean, what would be the other factors then? I mean, if it's, you know, if it's just a matter of oil, then, you know, I mean, is there something deeper in society? Like, I mean, accepting the legitimacy of a king. I mean, I understand.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think we have any evidence that kings or emirs are seen as more legitimate in these states than they were in Iraq in the 1950s, or Egypt in the 1950s, or Libya in the 1960s, or Yemen in the 1960s, when monarchs were overthrown in these places. I mean, we really don't have any independent evidence of the level of quote-unquote legitimacy of these regimes. We certainly know that there's historical, you know, they're rooted historically. There's no question about that. And these regimes spend a lot of time and effort and political capital and money to promote a picture of themselves as kind of emerging from the authentic cultural traditions of these countries. But it seems to me that we have to be careful not to buy their own propaganda, so to speak. I mean, we certainly know that Bahrain had a regime shaking crisis. And it would be hard to argue that the Bahraini monarchy overcame that crisis because of the enormous amounts of legitimacy its citizens, you know, felt for it. No, it overcame that crisis because it had regional allies that were willing to support it in a security solution to a major popular mobilization for political reform. So yeah, I tend not to buy into the legitimacy arguments. I tend to think of this as a more in terms of these are regimes that have been able to provide, because of oil wealth, a pretty high level of standard of living for their population, certainly compared to neighboring states, and have been able to provide a pretty secure and stable domestic political environment, again, compared to the regional environment, and that has gotten them, you know, some amount of acceptance. And then that extra money to pass around in times of crisis is really convenient. You know, if the Arab Spring had happened when oil prices were low, you know, would results have been different? It's a question that we can't answer on the counterfactual. But I think I think that things might have been very different.
Then let me ask you, in terms of ongoing sort of, you know, security and being able to hold on to a position of power, I mean, are we seeing sort of the argument being made that, you know, sort of, you know, Saudi Arabia or Kuwait sort of pointing to Syria, Iraq, and Libya, saying that, you know, look what upheaval has brought. You know, the alternative to us is, you know, chaos. I mean, is that sort of interwoven with, you know, the greater factor of oil money and, you know, distribution of goods?
It's a major theme in all of these states, certainly in Saudi Arabia. I think that's a selling point that all of these countries implicitly use with their populations.
So let's move on to policy. So, you know, especially, you know, what has been the Gulf states, their reaction towards the Arab Spring, but for, you know, with a sort of focus on Egypt, because I think, you know, Egypt is in the news again, and we're seeing that, you know, they're delivering aid to Egypt, I think on the scale of $12 billion. So, I mean, what has been the Gulf's reaction towards the Arab Spring in Egypt?
Right. Well, we can't say that there's a Gulf reaction. We have to break it down country by country, because you get this Saudi-Qatari rivalry. It's obvious that the Saudis and most of the Gulf states, I'd say with the exception of Qatar, were extremely upset by the fall of Mubarak. I mean, Mubarak was their major regional ally in the Arab world for Saudi Arabia. And the fall of Mubarak was something that really shook the Saudis up. And the Saudis and particularly the Emiratis didn't like the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood did so well in the elections. I mean, they see the brothers as a regional organization that's attempting to extend its political influence beyond the borders of Egypt throughout the whole region. I think that this is an exaggeration, and that the quote-unquote threat from the Brotherhood, the transnational threat from the Brotherhood that the Emiratis in particular talk about, is widely, vastly overblown by them. But that's the way they see it. The Qataris, on the other hand, were very comfortable with the brothers, and for well over a decade have been cultivating the Muslim Brotherhood as kind of a regional friend, if not an ally, of the Qatari regime. From the Yusuf al-Qaradawi being in Doha and broadcasting on Al Jazeera, to all sorts of support that the Qataris were willing to give to the brothers and other Islamist groups, they were pretty happy with the Brotherhood and were willing to put their money behind the Brotherhood government. Now that the Brotherhood has been turfed out by the military and by a popular uprising in Egypt, the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Kuwaitis have come in with promises of cash. Now, let's be careful about that $12 billion, right? Some amount of that $12 billion, in fact, the majority of it, is not going to be just a cash grant. It's going to be money deposited in the Egyptian central bank, kind of in a non-interest account, in order to support the Egyptian pound. Because the Egyptians, of course, have been drawing down their foreign reserves, and there was fear that the pound would collapse in value. So what you're getting is some amount of money coming from the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis to the new Egyptian government as grant money, but more of that money coming in as just kind of deposits in the central bank to support the pound.
So, I mean, in terms of Egypt, I mean, has the Gulf, have the these individual states, have they run into the issue of, you know, money doesn't equal governance? Because it seems like in our previous conversations with people, you know, on Egypt, you know, the issue of governance, you know, creating order, you know, keeps coming up. But then, you know, investing in the central bank and, you know, making sure the pound stays afloat doesn't really seem like it's not, you know, going towards, you know, creating governance or creating, you know, solving the constitution. I mean, is the end goal here just to sort of prop up the military and to make sure that, you know, the military comes back to rule, or is the sort of the end goal, you know, I don't even know what is the end goal?
Well, I don't think that we should assume that the Saudis and the Emiratis have a governance plan for Egypt. I think that they're reacting on a very kind of short-term basis to what they see as, you know, a defeat for a group that they didn't like, the Muslim Brotherhood. The only, really the only kind of power element that they have in their portfolio is money. And so they're willing to use that, and they have a lot of it now because oil is has been priced so high for the last decade. They've got plenty of money to spend, and they're willing to spend it on governments that that they think are more will be more aligned with them. I actually think that we're in a very interesting situation here vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, because for decades Saudi Arabia promoted Islamism, and a particular kind of Islamism, Salafi Islamism, in regional politics, you know, as a counterweight to Nasserist pan-Arabism and communism and leftism, and then as a counterweight to Iranian Shia Islamic revolutionary ideology. And now the Saudis have found that that over time that's come back to bite them, right? They don't like the brothers. They think that the brothers helped to create the atmosphere in which Al-Qaeda developed within Saudi Arabia. They think the brothers promote political activism, which, of course, is a threat to a non-democratic regime. They promoted Salafi jihadism in Afghanistan and to a lesser extent in the 90s in other places like Bosnia and Chechnya. And that came back to bite them with Al-Qaeda and bite them directly at home. So you've got a Saudi regime that doesn't like the Muslim Brotherhood, that worries about Salafi jihadists, that basically sees its own model of kind of quietist Salafis in support of the regime not exportable anymore as Salafis become more politically active, not just in Egypt, where they ran for parliament. And so I think the Saudis are kind of stuck ideologically, right? Their old tool of encouraging Salafi Islamism isn't necessarily going to serve their regime interests. And thus, what do they have left? They have money. And that's the only thing the Emiratis have, because they don't have a political model to export. They don't have an ideological model. And so these guys use money because that's what they've got. And I don't think that they have some long-term plan as to, you know, how Egypt should be governed. They see the guys governing Egypt now as folks that turfed out the guys that they didn't like, and so they're going to support them.
I mean, then is the long-term like really a problem? You know, it's for the Gulf, for Saudi Arabia, then the long-term is a U.S. problem in the sense that, you know, Saudi Arabia will deal with this short-term issue of, you know, putting money in the central bank, you know, making sure the pound stays afloat. But anything beyond that is, you know, it's the United States' problem, it's the EU's problem, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't think that the Saudis have much to offer the Egyptians besides money. It just seems to me that they're not going to they just don't have the wherewithal to help the Egyptian state develop a new model of governance. And they're not going to have that much influence, I don't think, in the development of the Egyptian state, aside from, you know, they'll support the people in Egypt who want to kind of keep the Brotherhood completely marginalized will say, we're going to lose that Gulf money if we don't do this. And that'll be a factor, obviously, in the way politics works within Egypt. But I think we have a tendency to exaggerate the Gulf's impact on events in Egypt. Undoubtedly, the Gulf states supported the military in getting rid of the Brotherhood. But, you know, a return of Mubarakism, which the Saudis would undoubtedly like, I'm not sure if they could achieve that in Egypt, given what's happened in the last 3 years. It'll be interesting to see. It'll be really interesting to see how all of this plays out, because I don't think that the Saudis have nearly the levers that many other people think they have in affecting the way Egyptian politics is going to develop.
So let's sort of switch, you know, from the issue of governance to the issue of violence, in particularly in Syria. So, I mean, you know, what has been Saudi Arabia's policy in terms of Syria? What has been Qatar's policy in terms of Syria? You know, do we just draw a circle around that and put versus Iran? You know, how has this played out for sort of the security dynamic?
Well, I think it's really interesting in that Saudi and Qatar were on the same page at the beginning in Syria. The Qataris, for their own general support for the Arab Spring and particularly for Muslim Brotherhood groups, and the Saudis because they wanted to decrease Iranian influence in the Arab world. But as the fighting continued in Syria, it became clear that the Saudis were kind of being marginalized as Turkey and Qatar became kind of the nexus for support for the anti-Assad fighters, particularly in the north of Syria. And the Saudis really didn't like the guys who were getting the guns. Again, this kind of ironic situation where the Saudis, the most Salafi Islamist regime in the world, worried about Salafi jihadists in Syria. And thus you see the Saudis trying to push the Free Syrian Army over other groups and to establish a new kind of arms pipeline through Jordan in the south to support the FSA and groups within the FSA that they liked, Salim Idris and people like that, as an alternative to what they saw as the Turkish-Qatari monopolization of support in the north and the real Islamist trend in that support from Turkey and Qatar. It's ironic, but I think that that's what the facts on the ground are. And so what we're seeing is the Saudis kind of opening up a second front in the south and promoting their own clients there. Now, it gets really jumbled on the ground because, you know, you can be the client of the Saudis and the Qataris. You'll take arms, if you're a Syrian fighter, you'll take arms wherever you can get them. And the ability to vet, the real ideological and political inclinations of these fighters, I think, is minimal, either for Washington or for Riyadh or for Doha or for Ankara, for that matter. But the Saudis clearly have tried to pursue an alternative path on Syria in the last year. And we're seeing the results of it now. We're also seeing the results in that, you're starting to get more news, more evidence of splits within the fighters in Syria, and Kurds against the Nusra Front and various opposition groups within Syria looking askance at each other. I think that that's partially the result of these differences internationally, and partially a result of real, you know, ideological and political differences within the opposition in Syria.
What has been the reaction of, you know, of Saudi Arabia to Qaradawi, or however you pronounce
Arabic? Oh, Yusuf al-Qaradawi in Qatar, yeah.
I mean, what has been the reaction of him calling, you know, the Syrian war a holy war, that in sort of encouraging people in the Gulf and elsewhere to go to jihad in Syria, that, you know, Syria is, pardon the phrasing, the new jihad. What has been the official response to that?
Well, the official response in Saudi Arabia all along has been that, and this is what the Grand Mufti in Saudi Arabia has said and what the Saudi media has emphasized and the Saudi government has said, is that Saudis should not go and fight in Syria. This is something for the government to handle. It's not for individuals, for those who are into, jihadist ideology and Islamic jurisprudence on this. The Saudis have said that this is the Saudi religious authorities said that this is the jihad in Syria is not Fard Ain, it's Fard Kifaya. So it's a collective responsibility, not an individual responsibility on individual Muslims to go. Now, that doesn't mean that there's plenty of Saudis that haven't gone to fight in Syria. There are plenty. But the official government position is don't go, because they've been bitten by the return of the Afghan Arabs and other jihadists that have come back into Saudi Arabia and joined the political opposition, joined al-Qaeda in the past. And so they're not encouraging that, but they are encouraging other people to fight in Syria. So they're in a hypocritical place, without a doubt, and a difficult political place They want the Assad regime to go. They're willing to support fighters, Syrians and non-Syrians, but they don't want Saudis to go because they fear the blowback.
So, I mean, in terms of, I mean, is there a tension then? I mean, you pointed out that it was hypocritical. I mean, it seems like, is the sort of holding Saudis back and saying that it's a collective responsibility, not an individual responsibility. I mean, is it really a matter of history of, you know, the Afghan Arabs and sort of, you know, to maybe use an exaggerated point of somebody like bin Laden or somebody, you know, is it really rooted in that sort of history, or is there, you know, something more political going on?
I think it's mostly the history in terms of the Saudi perspective. I think that you know, this kind of double game is not unusual in politics, and you know, whether it can be sustained or not, we'll have to see. But I think that's clearly what the Saudis are trying to do: encourage revolution and the fight in Syria against Assad, while trying to the greatest extent possible to insulate their own population from, you know, the revolutionary impact of, you know, another Salafi jihadist front on the model of Afghanistan or Chechnya from the past. We'll see if they can do it, but I think that's what they're after.
And then, I mean, why would sort of, you know, Qatar allow sort of that statement being made by Baradari? I mean, let me ask it this way. I mean, could Qatar just say, don't say that to him? Or is it more of a matter that, you know, Baradari has this huge audience and sort of can sort of use the power of the pulpit to sort of push people into going into jihad in Syria?
Well, I think it's really interesting. We're going to have to see the developments in Qatar. Obviously, Yusuf al-Qaradawi can say what he wants. You know, he's one of these guys who has such an enormous profile in the region that it's hard to close him down. And he's been an asset for Qatar and had a relationship with the Qataris for a long time. But, of course, we've seen a change at the top in Qatar just in the last couple of weeks with the old emir and his prime minister, the emir Sheikh Hamad, and his prime minister, Hamad bin Jassim, who were kind of the two guys who made this very aggressive, outreaching Qatari foreign policy. It was very much their own personal project. And now the emir has abdicated in favor of his son, and Hamad bin Jassim has left the prime ministership and the foreign minister position. And the new emir is kind of a cipher so far. We don't know what he thinks. It certainly appears that he's not going to be, at least at the beginning, as immediately aggressive in terms of Qatari foreign policy as his father and his cousin, Hamad bin Jassim, were. And thus we see a little bit, I don't want to exaggerate this because it's still early days with the shift in Qatar, and we don't really know what the new emir's long-term policies are going to be. But we've seen a lower profile from Qatar as Saudi Arabia has assumed more of the leadership role on the Syrian front. It will be very interesting to see whether this new emir, Emir Tamim, is going to pursue this very ambitious regional and global policy that his father did, not just in terms of supporting, you know, Islamist groups and Al Jazeera as a new information platform in the Arab world, but also, you know, in terms of the global economy, in terms of global sport, going out and getting the World Cup, that kind of thing. This was an incredibly ambitious agenda and very much the agenda of his father and Hamad bin Jassim. Whether he'll continue it or not is an open question.
So let me see, in terms of policy, where do we put Iran in all this? Because it seems like, you know, along with, you know, Gulf-funded groups and arms flowing to Syria, you also have Iran. You know, where do we put, you know, in terms of the Syrian conflict, where do we put Iran versus, you know, Saudi Arabia and Qatar.
Right. Well, I think Iran is still the most powerful regional player in the Middle East. It has predominant political influence in Iraq. Its ally in Syria is holding on when everyone thought it wouldn't. It has predominant political influence in Lebanon through Hezbollah. Obviously, it doesn't have the military power of an Israel or a Turkey, and it doesn't have the economic power of a Saudi Arabia with Saudi's enormous oil production. But it has a political influence in these weak Arab states, and to that extent, Syria is just one example of how Iran has been able to spread its political influence into the Arab world. Now there's also been a change at the presidency level in Iran. And the question, I think, in Iran is, will the confrontation with the United States and this very aggressive policy of extending influence into the Arab world come to be seen by the top decision makers in Iran as more trouble than it's worth, as more expensive than it's worth? One gets the impression that Rouhani would like to normalize relations with the Gulf states and de-escalate the crisis with the United States. But to do that, I think he's going to have to draw back both on the nuclear question and on kind of the Iranian role in the Arab world. Now, whether Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards will allow him the space to do that is an open question, but it's a fascinating one, and I think it's actually the most important question for the kind of short to medium term future of the international politics of the Gulf region and of the Middle East as a whole. Will Iran become a less revolutionary, a more status quo player with this change at the top? We'll see.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, the sense we got from, we've had previous conversations on Rouhani and sort of his role in foreign policy. I mean, and I think the impression we got was that he's very much sort of like Rafsanjani before. Mm-hmm. So the 8 years before Khatami, in the sense that, he's an insider, but he's a, pragmatic and sort of practical guy.
Right.
So in that sense, I mean, do you think Iran would, sort of place its relationships with the Gulf and sort of not necessarily mention the nuclear issue, not necessarily mention Syria, but rather say, look at our relationship 20 years ago when Rafsanjani was at, the head of this. We can build an economic relationship. We can build exchanges. So, I mean, is that possible, or is – or do we really, is the nuclear issue and the issue in Syria inseparable from everything?
Well, I think that the atmospherics are going to be better because Rouhani is a diplomat and Ahmadinejad was a bull in a china shop. So the atmospherics with the Gulf states are going to be better, no question. The question, though, is you can't separate these fundamental strategic issues from the nature of the relationship. Will Iran be willing to move back from its geopolitical gains in Iraq, for example, in order to have better relations with Saudi Arabia? Will it take a less supportive position toward Assad if the Saudis move away from the rebels? I think that we can't say that the Iranians are just going to give up the gains that they've made in the past decade geopolitically to have the Saudis smile at them. But I think that the Rouhani presidency at least offers the possibility that maybe instead of this kind of intense and very sectarianized competition, we might be able to get back to a more normal kind of balance of power political game that leaves open the possibility for moderation and compromise, which we really haven't seen in the last decade.
So, I mean, are there Gulf states that would be more open to sort of Iranian outreach? Because it seems like Qatar, Kuwait, and the UAE, the smaller Gulf states, would be sort of not malleable, but sort of open to outreach. Whereas it seems like with Saudi Arabia and Yemen, mostly Saudi Arabia, that sort of outreach wouldn't be as successful. I mean, yeah. Is there a sort of structure and design to Iran's approach, or is it really just a matter of winning Saudi Arabia and then everybody else will just follow?
You win Saudi Arabia, everybody else follows. Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman are the places that are most open to outreach. The Bahrainis see Iran as behind their domestic political troubles. The Bahraini government does, and so that's a hard case to make to the Bahrainis. And the UAE has the islands issue. The Abu Musa and the Tums Islands, these three islands that the Shah occupied in 71, that the Emiratis say are theirs, the Iranians say are theirs. It's a persistent kind of irritant in the relationship. But the key is Saudi Arabia. If Saudi-Iranian relations improve, relations with everybody else improve.
So let me sort of shift our conversation to U.S. policy. And, you know, in the sense that, what can the U.S. do besides, basing rights and sort of being a mediator? I mean, is there, in terms of policy, what can the United States do? How can it sort of insert itself into this very complex political situation?
Right. Well, we're certainly not a mediator. I mean, we're a player here, right?
Right.
We have a direct stake in. Relations with the smaller Gulf states in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the smaller Gulf states have American bases, right? They are the footprint of American military power in the region. We have this longstanding political relationship with Saudi Arabia. And we have a very clear stated policy that Iran, we will not permit Iran to become a nuclear power. So it's a nuclear weapons power. And thus we are in a... We are a part and parcel of this game. We're a player in the game, not a mediator. And it seems to me that the hierarchy of issues for the United States are first and foremost the Iranian nuclear issue. It's clear from our reluctance to get too involved in Syria that Syria isn't a major issue for us. You know, Syria is more important to Saudi Arabia than it is to the United States. And it seems, I think that the United States will be judging the Rouhani administration in Iran on the basis of how the nuclear question goes. And I think that the relationships with the smaller Gulf states in Saudi Arabia are seen as kind of a constant in Washington, you know, that they're our allies and we're with them.
So in terms of, I mean, if Iran were to nuclearize that, you know, move it from a, I don't know how to describe it, a pilot program, you know, domestic energy to explicitly weaponizing.
Yeah, kind of Pakistan, India, yeah.
Yeah. You know, in terms of the Gulf states, I mean, would they be willing to deepen their relationship with the United States in terms of, you know, the United States creating a nuclear umbrella or, you know, really, you know, how deep can this security relationship go? With the Gulf states?
Well, I think that there's a real structural irony here. I mean, to the extent that the Iranians go nuclear, the Gulf states will be quite disappointed in the United States, and they will have expected the United States to prevent this, and the United States will have failed. And yet, if Iran does go nuclear, the Gulf states have nowhere to turn but to the United States for security. Now, there is an issue, can the Saudis, can even the Emiratis obtain their own independent nuclear forces? But that would be a very hard thing to do, both technologically, I think, and politically. Because for the United States, it would be very difficult, given our non-proliferation policy, to say, oh, even if you have your own nuclear forces, we still want to maintain a really close security relationship with you. It would be a real risk for the Gulf states. So the irony is that if Iran does go nuclear, the Gulf states will see that as a failure of American policy. But I think that they'll be pushed to deepen their security relations with the United States even more.
So I think we've touched on everything and we've reached the end of the interview. And usually we like to, you know, let the guest have the last word. You know, did we forget something, you know? Give us a summary, give us an encapsulation comment, you know, you know, did we, you know, go ahead.
I think we hit about everything. I mean, the one thing we didn't talk about, of course, is the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which is connected to the Gulf through Lebanon, through Syria, through Jordan, through American policy in the region. But I think that you know, if I had a bottom line on this from the point of view of U.S. policy, is that U.S. policy appears confused in the Middle East in general at this time because we don't have a side in this fight. We don't like the Iranians, and we're trying to roll back their influence in Syria. But we don't like Salafi jihadists either, and so we're supportive of an Iraqi government that's very close to the Iranian government. People in the region look at us and say America is inconsistent. It doesn't have a consistent policy. But I think we don't have a consistent policy because we have a number of challenges and a number of potential enemies, and we are not putting ourselves on one side or another of this sectarian fight, of this Saudi-Iranian fight. And that makes it a very difficult line to walk.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Sure, my pleasure.